I'm Heidi Zuckerman. I've spent my life connecting people to art to make their lives better. This podcast talks about art in contemporary culture and why we should care. Each episode is an impactful conversation with people I find interesting and think you will too, about their life, values, and always about why they think art matters. This is Conversations About Art. Hey everyone, I love all of the podcasts, I have to say, and this one that you're about to hear with Nicole Perloff is really, really great. She and I met on a panel in Boulder, Colorado a couple of years ago. It was on Women in Power, and we start off this podcast talking about the two other women who were with us that day. It was a life-changing evening, I think, for all of us. Nicole and I certainly talk about that. But her story, the work that she's done, it's totally fascinating. We'll get there in just a minute. I don't know about you, but I get most of my things done in the spaces between doing everything else. And I gravitate towards the things I can handle from an app on my phone. Kelly Klee Private Client Insurance believes that people with more to lose need better protection for what they cherish. I have insured not only my cars and homes with them, but also my personal art collection. They have an incredibly well-designed app that's not only aesthetic, but the user interface is superb. I can see each work in my collection and its currently insured value, as well as seamlessly and easily, literally from my phone, add new things as they're acquired. Insurance to me sounds like kind of a boring thing to talk about, but particularly in these uncertain times, I sleep way better at night knowing that the things I love are protected. So check out their website, kellyklee.com/Heidi. That's kellyklee.com/Heidi. And they will make a $50 donation to Artadia, an art charity I've recommended, per each qualified referral. These details are included in the show notes. Is there a piece of jewelry you would like to create? I'm excited to tell you about Best & Co., which offers a smarter way to acquire luxury jewelry. I wanted to create signet rings for each member of my family. Best & Co. worked with me to create a custom design and fabricate the rings. We all love them. The rings are a daily and physical reminder of our connection, even when we're not together. Whether you want to reuse sentimental stones from a family heirloom or create a piece that you have been dreaming about, Best & Co. can help you create it, and their effective and efficient business model allows them to provide significant savings to their clients. Clients regularly save as much as 30%, and frequently more, when compared with purchasing comparable high-quality pieces from traditional luxury jewelry retailers. So check out their website, www.bestandcoaspen.com, and use discount code Heidi2020 to receive 5% off of any item on Best & Co.'s website. I was just looking at it today, and honestly, there are a ton of things that I would like to use that discount code for. Also, if you're interested in creating a custom piece, you can email custom@bestandcoaspen.com. That's bestandcoaspen.com, and mention that you heard about Best & Co. on my podcast to receive the special discount. Nicole Perloff covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times. She has covered Russian hacks of nuclear plants, airports, and elections, North Korea's cyber attacks against movie studios, banks, and hospitals, Iranian attacks on oil companies, banks, and the Trump campaign, and hundreds of Chinese cyber attacks, including a months-long hack of the Times. Her first book, quote, "This is how they tell me the world ends," unquote, about the global cyber arms race, was published in February 2021. The book and several of her Times articles have been optioned for television. A Bay Area native, Nicole is a guest lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and a graduate of Princeton University and Stanford University. She and I discuss moving to California, choosing to leave an enviable position, naming and shaming Chinese and Russian hackers and hackers for hire, vulnerabilities, being a storyteller, 0 days, spy agencies, being a target, managing paranoia, election threats, being a mom and a female journalist, acting on what you must care about, the humans that are involved, and what they tell us.
Hi, Heidi.
Hey, Nicole. Nice to hear your voice.
How are you? Are you in Aspen?
Well. You know, I'm not. I was thinking about that. I'm in California now, and I know you are too.
Oh my gosh. Where in California are you?
I recently started as the CEO and director of the Orange County Museum of Art.
So you've left Aspen?
I have left Aspen. And I was thinking about the fact that when we met, you were also living in Colorado.
I know. I'm happy to be closer to the ocean air, to be honest with you.
Oh my God. Me too.
But Aspen is its own. That must have been hard to leave.
Yes. And I mean, I'm still there sometimes, but I was traveling this weekend and I got back yesterday. I went straight to the museum and then I got home last night kind of late-ish. And as I was coming up to my house, I got a glimpse of the ocean and it was just like, it made my heart happy.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, I mean, I love the mountains so much and I love being up high and I feel really grounded in the mountains and something about the ocean just speaks to my soul.
Yeah. Even, you know, I realized even if I'm not looking at the ocean every day, when I would come back to the Bay Area from Boulder, and I would walk out of SFO and get a drink of the air. That's how I would describe it. Like it was like a milkshake of just moist air. And until you're living without it, you don't realize how much you crave it. And so when I was super pregnant and I was just like wanted to scratch my body off in the mountains because the air was so dry, I was just forced my husband to promise me that we would move back to California, and here we are. But did you see what happened with Julie? With that Mila passed away?
No,
yeah. I've been.
When did that happen? Because I've been
just in the last
tabs
month.
On that. Oh,
yeah, I know.
Okay, I mean, I felt like that was impending, and I was tracking that, but I missed her actual passing. So that's just devastating.
I know.
That has been a tough road.
Yeah. Well, I think that at some point, not right now, but maybe in a year or something, once this period passes, I think she should write a book about motherhood and motherhood to the extreme. And I mean, just her whole story about being an executive for Ducati and then, you know, being forced to go into this totally other role. And then this is just, I mean, worthy of a movie or, you know, so I'm sure there's a lot of people after this year who could identify with some of it. So.
And just the prioritization of, you know, what matters most in the world. And it was one of the things I wanted to talk with you about today, because we did meet on that panel about women in power, which was such a, for me, complicated topic. And and I've thought a lot about that since that day. Mm-hmm. And actually, Rena is in California now too. So, which is really funny that now 3 out of the 4 of us live in California from Colorado. But I have thought a lot about Julia's situation. And when you have to choose between everything in the world, what do you choose to put all of your time and energy and love and focus on?
Yeah.
And being a mom, there's just never a question for me. What comes first?
Right.
And I don't know that that's everyone's perspective. And I'm not saying it's, you know, good or bad, whatever anyone chooses. I just know that mm-hmm. that's where it is for me. And that's how it's always been.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you say that, and I'm happy to talk about it. But just yesterday, I kind of quit my position at the New York Times for that very reason. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to stay on as a writer. I'm just going to do it in mm-hmm. a different capacity that's more sustainable mm-hmm. for me and for being a mom and not being on call all the time. And yeah, I mean, I've been on the treadmill of this subject matter for the last decade. The book is basically everything I've learned, you know, to the American public and everyone else. And I just get called. If I'm not writing a story a weekend, I'm getting called by various editors to consult on whether the thing that just happened is a news story worthy of the New York Times pages. And that happens during bath time and during,
of course,
diaper time and during, you know, and I've just lost my general appetite for it because it's like someone asked me in an interview, it's like cyber war fatigue, you know, it's like mm-hmm. covering a war for 10 years. And usually at the Times, if someone covers a campaign for 3 years, you know, they're exhausted after, and we switch them to the Home and Garden beat or something. Right. And I've been doing this for 10 years and I just can't, I'm losing my appetite to cover every single development because it's no longer surprising to me anymore. And so I'm moving to something I'm excited about, which is I'm going to pick 5 really good stories I want to do a year that are about cybersecurity, but not about cyber war. Like I'll be looking at, you know, poachers and conservationists and how they have to essentially hack each other these days to stay ahead of the game. And so how are they approaching this in the world of, you know, wildlife conservation? So, you know, I won't be abandoning it, but I'll just be applying it to these things I care a lot about. So that's that.
I've been reading The Tao, one a day mm-hmm. for 81 days. Wow. And I started it in Colorado knowing that I would end here in California uh-huh. and that I would uh-huh. be about 6 weeks into my new job on step 81 on the last one. Mm-hmm. And then I took 2 or 3 days kind of off and I missed it because it was one of the first things I did each morning as part of my morning routine. And mm-hmm. my son, who I'm super fortunate, is back living with me after mm-hmm. having been at boarding school and a year and a half in college. He's doing an online term this term. And it's mm-hmm. so amazing, you know, to wake up with, you know, one of my kids in the house every day mm-hmm. Again, which is phenomenal. But he said, well, you know, why don't you start again? And I was like, oh my gosh, of course. So today for me is step 9 and it is exactly what you're talking about. And I feel like I just want to read it to you, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Step 9, and of course, there are all sorts of interpretations, but this is the one that I'm reading, which is by Solala Towler. And so step 9 is, overfilling a vessel is not as good as stopping before it is filled. Oversharpen mm-hmm. a blade and it will lose its edge. Pile up gold and jade and it will be impossible to guard it. In going after rank and titles in an arrogant and haughty way, you will bring about your own downfall. Withdraw when the work is done. This is the way of Tao.
I needed that. That was speaking to me in a big way. Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Withdraw when the work is done.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've done it. And it doesn't mm-hmm. mean that you're not then doing something equally mm-hmm. important. But if you mm-hmm. still do the same thing over and over, mm-hmm. then you can't know what your next thing is. And I mean, right. that was like me with Aspen too. I mean, 14 and a half mm-hmm. years.
Wow.
So it's hard to leave something that's amazing, you know, but there are other things that are, it's not that they're more amazing. They're like differently amazing, you know, but they're equal or better.
Right. Right.
Because they're different.
Yeah. A lot of people will say to me, you know, sometimes people who don't know me, I'll say, I'll drop something, well, something about the New York Times. And they say, wait, you work for the New York Times? And I say, oh yeah, I write about cybersecurity and espionage for the New York Times. And they say, like, you're a staffer? You're like, you're on staff? I say, yes, I am a staffer employed by the New York Times. And so now, you know, that I'm going to have to answer that question a little differently. I'll still be writing for the New York Times, but I'm going to move to a contract role. And so, you know, that might matter a lot to some people. And I think it's going to matter a lot to me. And it's going to be an identity shift because for the last decade, I've been Nicole Perlerath from the New York Times. And now I'm going to have to alter the wording a little bit. But, you know, that's a big deal for a lot of people. And a lot of people stay there for three decades because they can't imagine waking up one day and not being able to say from the New York Times. But I just think things are different now. And I actually think I can have a bigger impact doing a few stories I really care about than just being exhausted, picking up the phone and you know, speeding out 500 words on deadline about something that I could have covered, that I've already covered a million different ways. That's just happening more frequently. And, you know, so
that was something that I dealt with also. What does it mean to just have my name, right? And to just be me rather than to say, you know, I'm Heidi Zuckerman, CEO and director of the Aspen Art Museum. You know, it was like, I'm Heidi Zuckerman. It's like, well, what, you know, what do you do? Well, I used to be, or I'm the former, or, and that took a little while to process and own. And when I was awkward about answering, then people were awkward in hearing. But then when I kind of came up with the language around what it is I was doing or thinking, then it felt more comfortable. And then it also gave me the space to say, like, okay, I actually do really like doing this. And so again, now I'm Heidi Zuckerman, the CEO and director of the Orange County Museum of Art. But in that time, I had to think about, well, what matters most to me? And it, I mean, the timing, I believe in divine timing, and I believe that everything happens exactly as it is supposed to. And to have that coincide with COVID and having my kids, both of them back at home. And I mean, hundreds of family dinners over the last year. I mean, so fabulous, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have had it any other way. And I feel so incredibly grateful for it. But that idea of what matters most to me is always family first. And also secondarily, like amplifying the voice of art and artists. And for me, what was the best forum to do that? And I believe still that it is a museum, but I took some time to make sure instead of just having that be a given.
And I mean, you were just such a powerful voice on that panel we did when speaking about art, that how cool that you're doing this podcast, talking to people about their art. So
exactly.
You know, you're feeding your soul in many different ways.
Yeah. And this is what I spent most of the last year doing and realized I can do both, or I can do, you know, multiple things. So what I wanted to ask about is the reviews of your book. A lot of them have talked about what an incredible journalist you are and how you were able to piece together information and stories and get access and interpret and weave together things that no one else could figure out. And I was thinking about you doing that on that time frame that you just talked about, and how the benefit of maybe doing less gives you the opportunity to do what you do so incredibly well, maybe even better. And I wonder what you think about that, and if you could talk about some of the strategies that you use to do the work that you do. How do you approach it?
Well, that's a great question. So I think everyone in this world that I've been immersed in for the last 10 years, cybersecurity or whatever you want to call it, attack, cyber war, over the last decade, I think the big problem is everyone immersed in it hasn't had time or space to pull their head up and process what just happened, because things happen so quickly. Every year, I mean, from the minute I joined the Times, we were hacked by China. I was immersed in that for several months. I published a story about it, and that enabled the US government to start naming and shaming Chinese military hacking units who'd been hacking all sorts of companies and government agencies and defense contractors for years, but they never had the voice to do it. But once my story came out, that gave them sort of permission to start really calling out these actors and pursuing this strategy of naming and shaming. And so just when I thought I was done with the big story, I realized the story had only just begun. And everything that's happened since then has been similar in that, you know, just when I thought I was about to take a break from Chinese cyber espionage, Edward Snowden came out with leaks from the NSA, and I got thrown into that project. And then Russia hacked the 2016 elections, and I got thrown into that. And on and on and on and on. And so it was really only in writing the book, and the only way I could do the book was to be a night owl and put my toddler to sleep and then creep out to my studio in our backyard and start writing this thing in the middle of the night when my phone wasn't buzzing and notifications weren't going off and I could hear the owls outside. And it was only in those really quiet, dark morning hours when I could actually process what was happening. And what was happening, it had a pretty clear through line, which is that we've always been vulnerable. It's just that other adversaries were finding new ways to take advantage of those vulnerabilities, but we weren't changing the way we did business. We individuals were still motivated to just get what we want right now on our phones immediately. We weren't thinking about turning on two-factor authentication and password management and not clicking on links and attachments. And businesses just wanted to get their product out to market first, the whole move fast and break things mantra that Mark Zuckerberg talked about a lot. And then there was this other thing where governments were actually holding on to information about vulnerabilities in our software so they could use it to spy on other nation states and terrorist groups and drug cartels. And they didn't want to see those holes patched. So the status quo was leading us down a path of further vulnerability. And each attack, it wasn't so much that the attacks were getting more serious. It's just that people were waking up to the potential of using all of these systems and data against us. And I couldn't see that when I was working on deadline every day, just trying to keep paddling and keep going and meet my deadlines. It was only kind of in those dark morning hours when I could finally put two and two together. And I don't think I could have written this book had I not already been covering this space for so long. Like, so much of what I was referencing in the book was just hidden in the recesses of my mind. They weren't in clear note form on my computer stored somewhere in a notepad. They were just anecdotes that had come to me over the years that I really hadn't had time to put in their proper place. And so that was the power of the book, was being able to process all of these things that were hanging out in my mind in different corners and realizing that they had this common through line and pulling them all together. So I'm happy that the reviewers sort of picked up on that. And, you know, I've always been a storyteller. I've always been a storyteller, much more so than I identify as a cybersecurity expert or cybersecurity reporter. And not many people in this space identify as storytellers. You know, most of them are very technical. So having, you know, using that to my advantage, having the ability to step back and tell the story and bring in these common threads, I think was really my goal with the book. And fortunately, a lot of people have seen that.
Did you have an aha moment? Did you have that kind of lightning strike where you were like, oh my God, this is what this all is?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, my moment, so, you know, some of the book, a large part of the book focuses on this underground market for vulnerabilities in software, which sounds very technical, but it's not. It's just that, you know, it's just, I was stunned by this idea that we, the American taxpayer, fund programs under the assumption that the government is keeping us safe, when in reality, these programs are used to find vulnerabilities, not to turn them over to Apple and Google or Microsoft, but to hold on to them to preserve their own espionage advantage. And I was just stunned by this idea that we were paying to keep ourselves less safe, because, you know, 10 years ago, even maybe two decades ago, the US was using different software than the Chinese and Russia, but we're all using the same software now. We all use Android phones and iPhones, and whether you know it or not, we're all using Microsoft Windows. So this idea just got more and more surprising to me, that we were helping fund programs to keep ourselves less safe. And what do these programs look like? I know they're classified. I know everyone who participates in this market can't talk about it because they've signed non-disclosure agreements. And so I really just wanted to get behind the market and find the characters involved and tell the story of this market, with each chapter being about one character who sort of stood for that segment of the market, whether it was a hacker or the intelligence agencies or the brokers who'd come in to meet government demands, or the foreign companies that emerged in the space that were selling these vulnerabilities and hacking tools to governments like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, who were using them against journalists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if I had any aha moment, it was just that, wow, you know, the US government helped catalyze this market. We were some of the biggest sponsors of this market. In the 90s, we started paying hackers and brokers good money, you know, $150,000 early on for a hole in your Microsoft Windows software so we could spy on our enemies. But we also, in the process, helped show all these other governments, allies and adversaries, the way. We showed them, with several high-profile attacks we conducted, that these vulnerabilities aren't just critical for espionage these days, but for battlefield preparations. You can use a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows to hack the power grid. You could use it to get into a hospital. You can use it to get into election systems. And so we've sort of showed every other government on Earth just how valuable these vulnerabilities are. And when I had one aha moment, it was when I went down to Argentina. I went to this hacking conference in Buenos Aires, and I'd been told that Argentine hackers were really good at finding vulnerabilities and weaponizing them, and that they were selling them to various governments around the world. And that was in large part due to just their culture. They have very good public education in math and science, but because of export controls, they don't have ready access to iPhones and Amazon Prime and the apps and games that we all take for granted. So young Argentines who have a technical background have essentially learned how to hack to get access to the things we take for granted in the United States. And that has made them a natural talent pool to find these vulnerabilities and weaponize them. And they can make $1 million selling one of these to a government under the table tax-free. And so I went down to get a glimpse at this culture and this market and what it looked like in Argentina. And one day I went out to lunch with this man who really identifies as sort of the godfather of the Argentine hacking scene. And I asked him a really stupid question. I said, so, are these young Argentine hackers, are they only selling to good Western governments? And he laughed in my face and he said, Nicole, good Western governments, You know, last time I checked, the country that bombed another country into oblivion wasn't Iran or China. We don't think of the United States as a good Western government. In fact, the United States looked the other way during Argentina's dirty wars when the military was essentially killing its own people. So we don't think of you as a good Western government. We sell to whoever brings us the biggest bag of cash. And that was the biggest aha moment for me, that, you know, the US might have spawned this market, might have catalyzed it, but it was so far beyond the United States control these days. And there are so many other governments out there that want access to these tools, and they can just buy them off this market, whether it's in whether it's from Argentine hackers in Buenos Aires or China or wherever. And people can make good money, and there's nothing really we can do to stop them. And so that was sort of the big, you know, HOLYSHIT moment that these tools were about to come back to bite us in a really bad way.
So these vulnerabilities that you're referencing, that's what the 0 days are?
Yes. And just, you know, it's the most technical part of the book, but it's a short part. So, you know, let's just say I'm a hacker. I find a vulnerability in your iPhone iOS software. I can write a program to exploit it, to read your text messages, to track your location, to turn on your audio or your camera on your phone without you knowing about it. I can access your contacts, your phone calls, and I can sell that to governments for a really good price point. In the US, there are brokers who on their websites will offer $2.5 million for that capability to hackers all over the world. And then in the course of writing this book, I found a broker who works exclusively for the Saudis and the Emiratis who offer $3 million for that same capability. So we're already getting outbid here in the United States. But you know, that is essentially all a spy agency wants or needs to track their enemies. And here in the United States, we're buying zero-day exploits to spy on, you know, Russian diplomats' conversations at the embassy in Kiev, or we're trying to track terrorists or drug cartels. And in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they're using that same capability to hack their Twitter critics and other critics of the monarchy and journalists and dissidents. And so everyone has their own reason for wanting to purchase these tools. And there's just a ready talent pool of hackers all over the world who can make a lot of money finding these vulnerabilities, these 0 days, turning them into 0 day exploits, which is just the name for, you know, a weaponized vulnerability that you can use to spy on people. And there's this whole market for them, but no one ever wanted to talk about it. And so that's the market that became the focus of this book.
You talked about the brokers and their websites. Is that on the dark web? Is that accessible to anyone who is just searching Google? Do people have to know how to find it? How do people access this information, right? Because you can imagine, you talked about the different reasons why governments would be interested in utilizing these vulnerabilities. But I was just thinking about everyday people who are angry at an ex-spouse or a former boss. And the other day, someone asked me, you know, why we're having all these mass shootings. And that's another place that we can go. But, you know, there are clearly a lot of people that are really upset and angry about a lot of things. Mm. And that's a problem for the larger society. And what you're talking about is on such a huge macro level. What happens though on a smaller micro level? Like who has access to these things?
Yeah. So the broker I was talking about, it's just on the internet. You can go to zerodium.com and click on price lists, and you can see their price list for every piece of widely available commercial technology out there. But they only sell to governments. And one of the things that really drew me to telling this story was there's no regulations on this market for the most part. governments aren't regulators in this market. They are customers, and they have very little incentive to regulate this market. There's some legacy rules out there on the export of encryption that still exist, where you can't sell these tools to Cuba or Iran or Syria, or countries that are on a list of governments that are applied to these old encryption export controls. But for the most part, you can sell to the Turkish military. You can sell to, I just mentioned the United Arab Emirates, the Saudis. So, you know, you can sell to a long list of countries that we nominally consider allies that don't exactly have the best human rights track records or the same privacy protections that we do here in the United States. And so where that leaves us is a place where we are left at the whim of these hackers and brokers' own moral compass. And that was really fascinating to me. And I wanted to meet as many people as I could who would talk to me in this market to understand where their moral compass lied, and if they had any qualms about selling to certain customers. And no one wanted to talk about their customers. And we can talk about that a little bit. But as far as your question is concerned, there's a whole other sub-tier of this that you can buy 0 days and 0 day exploits on the dark web, which is largely a market dictated by cyber criminals. But yes, you can go on the dark web and you can buy these 0 day exploits, or you can just buy commercial off-the-shelf hacking tools. And there is a whole healthy market for hackers for hire that you could use, which are probably going to be much easier than trying to buy a 0 day exploit and figuring out how to use it on your enemies. And that hacker for hire market is largely plays out on the dark web. And yes, people have used it to hack their ex-spouses and their corporate competitors and all sorts of people. Those are just click and shoot tools. Those are pretty easy to use. And I would have to go search around the dark web for the latest prices for those tools, but they're not cheap. And there is an entire market that's crept up to meet that demand too.
You described thinking about this and writing kind of under cover of night, and that word choice even was so evocative of sort of an emotive state as well as, you know, the time. And I wonder, with this information that you know is out there and the fact that it is really like an ongoing and continuous, and it sounds like, you know, perpetually unending war, how do you manage that information? How do you approach every day with this knowledge that, and of course, I think that's, I can make that assumption that that's why you wrote the book, right? Is to hope that, you know, as more people know about this, maybe it can be addressed mm-hmm. somehow. But how do you manage that personally? Mm-hmm. This weight of knowledge that you have?
Yeah. You know, I read this book, Red Notice, which I loved, which was by Bill Browder, who is one of the biggest foreign asset holders in Russia for a long time. He ran a hedge fund in Russia. And Putin and his cronies sort of dismantled his hedge fund one piece at a time and end up torturing and killing his lawyer and leaving that torture on his voicemail. And it changed his life, and he switched from being a hedge fund investor to what he called an accidental activist. And he set out to punish everyone who was involved in the torture and murder of his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, and eventually got laws passed with the help of John McCain in those early days, to sanction anyone, starting with the prison guards, as high as they could go into, Russian oligarchs for his murder. And they've applied it to other dissidents and activists as well. But at the end of the book, which is why I'm referencing it, he says, you know, the reason I'm writing this book is should anything happen to me, you will know who did it. And he was speaking directly about Vladimir Putin. And that stuck with me because there was a freedom for him in writing this all, putting it into a chronology, putting the through line there, and calling out those who, you know, might try to hurt him. And I don't think my situation is that dire. As far as I know, I'm not on Putin's enemy list, but there are certain parallels. And I, very early on, you know, when Chinese hackers hacked the New York Times, I was embedded with our security team and our security, private security responders for a long time, for several months, because we wanted to make sure we kicked the hackers out of the New York Times system before we wrote about it. And during that period, I couldn't really tell anyone at work, even my direct editors, what I was working on. It was sort of this super secret project that the managing editor was working on with me and asked me not to share what I was doing. And so sort of, I was in my 20s, late 20s, maybe I was 30. I was living by myself in San Francisco. And one night, my cable box just started making really erratic noises. And I had covered attacks where a company had thought they had kicked Chinese hackers out of their system, only to find 3 months later that their thermostat in their corporate apartment was still communicating with a Chinese IP address, and their printer started printing out reams of characters in Mandarin. And so I started getting pretty paranoid. And so there was this night in the middle of the night where I ripped my cable box out of the wall, convinced that Chinese hackers were inside trying to monitor me as I was telling the story about the New York Times getting hacked by China. And in the morning, I woke up and there was that golden morning light on my cable box, you know, being ripped out, sitting on my bedroom floor. And I just made the decision right then and there that I was not going to live my life like someone walking around with a tinfoil hat on, paranoid that every little noise was some kind of hacker or spy, and that I would just do the best I could to protect my sources and my personal data. But, you know, if someone like the Chinese military wanted to hack my phone, there was probably very little I could do to stop them. And so I've carried that mindset with me for the last 10 years. And sometimes, you know, I get a little paranoid and sometimes I talk myself down from it. But, you know, when I was writing this book, it was really helpful that I would escape to the mountains sometimes. You know, I said I would work in the middle of the night here in my little studio in my backyard. But sometimes I had to sort of get away from being a mom for a couple of days. My husband would let me go escape to my family's cabin in the Sierras near Lake Tahoe. And we barely have Wi-Fi there. If we have it, but it barely works. And we don't have a Nest or an Alexa or a smart fridge or any sort of Internet of Things. And I just remember feeling really safe there as I was putting everything I knew down on paper and sort of realizing that that's how I want to live. I don't want to live with these internet connected devices all around me. And of course, there are certain things I'm never going to be able to escape, like my car's GPS navigation system or my iPhone. But I can turn it off and put it in another room. You know, that there are certain things I can do to feel like I have some control over my life in this world I'm steeped in, and other things that are totally out of my control, and knowing how to tell the difference. It's pretty critical to keeping my sanity. But the other thing is, you know, I got a good therapist, and he over and over again, I think, was worried about how what I was seeing every day, what I was reporting on, was coloring my worldview. And it did get to a point where he said, I think this is giving you a really dark worldview, and I don't think you should commit to doing this forever. And I don't know when that moment will come for you. but that moment came for me. And it came for me, I think, after this last election cycle, when I'd really just dedicated my life to covering various threats to the election. And I thought, once this election is over, I can take a break. But of course, it was the election that never ended. And then there was a giant Russian attack on our federal IT systems. And I wasn't even able to really have a holiday vacation. And then came January 6th and the insurrectionists at the Capitol. And that had its own cybersecurity angles to it. And I just realized it was never going to end. In fact, these attacks and disinformation and cyber threats were only going to get more frequent and more serious as time went on, because we weren't doing anything to stop them. And I felt like, okay, well, my book comes out February 9th, and this is the sum total of everything I have learned over the last 10 years. And I am calling out things that no one knows about. No one knows that these programs exist for the most part. And this is my offering. And once I've presented my offering, I will think about how to back up and sort of recalibrate my life. So I'm not just constantly immersed in these threats and this landscape. And that's what I'm doing right now.
It's so interesting. I have talked a couple of times on the podcast about my work with Rand Stegen and the Stegen Institute out of Dallas, mm-hmm. and the hero's journey and my hero's journey. And the panel that we were on together in Boulder, you know, became kind of a key factor in that, because in that panel, that was the first time that I ever publicly told the story and named Kevin Conzi, who was my boss at the Berkeley Art Museum, in terms of how I was treated after I had my second kid and, you know, what I was told I could or couldn't do in that role, and how that interaction was the key factor in my decision to become a museum director. And now I would say, ironically, but I know that there are no coincidences and everything is serendipitous, I'm now the director of a museum that he used to be the director of. And my current journey, so my first journey was really about that, coming into that role in that sort of museum leadership. But my current journey is about a balance between freedom and control, and I guess control and freedom, and this idea of giving up control to find freedom. And it's a really big and complicated concept and idea, and I'm just sort of throwing it out there in a quick way as a response to some of the things that you've just said. And I offer that as a thing to think about, and a question for you about how you think the two things might relate to each other, and if you've thought about them together or separately or interrelatedly.
Well, I haven't had a lot of freedom over the last 10 years. And I've just been on the treadmill, and, or, you know, some call it, what is it, the hamster wheel of the news. And it's not like it was 20 years ago, where it was, you know, a 9-to-5 job, unless something crazy happened. It's a 24-hour, 7 days a week job now, because the news never sleeps. And so I haven't had a lot of freedom, but there were passages that I would write in my book where I just felt immense freedom being able to write in my voice, Nicola's voice, not the New York Times voice. Being able to even just use the word I was very liberating. You know, no journalist at the New York Times feels comfortable putting the word I or me into their stories, and our readers aren't there to read about us. But this book that I wrote was about my journey too, from someone who knew nothing about cybersecurity, who actually, I write in the book that I actually went out of my way to know as little about cybersecurity as possible. And to someone who knows a lot about this world, but still from, you know, someone, the experience of someone who's very green, and being able to just write that story was really liberating. And then these days, you know, I want more freedom because I still am a mom and I do bath time at night. And I found myself more and more under the mind control of men, for the most part, on Twitter, who are just vitriolic and mean and bullying and harassing to female journalists in particular on Twitter. And cybersecurity in particular is a space that's dominated by men who are very technical, who treat these issues, rightfully in some cases, as religious ones, who hate the way that I've sort of democratized the language of their trade for my readers in the New York Times and for the book. I read, you know, you mentioned the glowing reviews. There's been a couple of reviews from people in the information security technical space who said the book had too many feelings in it. And
so funny.
I just found those criticisms, you know, following me to bath time and, you know, taking more and more control of my life and my mindset. And so, you know, this is all to say that I've made the decision to really back up, get off the treadmill, get off the hamster wheel, pick 5 stories I really care about that use my sourcing, use my network, use what I've gleaned over the last 10 years. I'm not abandoning it. I'm not walking away from it, but I want to apply it to areas that I really care about, like wildlife conservation. I think a really interesting untold story is how this new breed of company that sells software to marijuana dispensaries, they keep hacking each other, not for espionage, corporate espionage, but to really like take each other offline to drive business away from each other. Like no one has told that story. And I'm sure that, you know, I know it's happening in that space, but I'm sure it's happening in lots of others. And I just haven't had time to tell that story because as soon as I start doing a few interviews, Russia hacks our federal IT networks, or China hacks, you know, our most vibrant technology companies, or some hospital gets hit with ransomware. And so now I have chosen to structure my life in a way that I can dedicate myself to really telling those stories the same way I approach the book, which is through humans, through the human story, through the hero's journey, through the characters, instead of through the news cycle. And I think, you know, more than ever, I really do feel liberated. And so that's probably how I'd answer that question.
Your book has like a heart stopping title. Will you tell our listeners what it is and how you came to it? And could you maybe also talk about its conversion to, I don't know if it's a TV show or a TV movie, mm-hmm. and your role or involvement in that too? Mm-hmm.
So the book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And it came to me like most good ideas do in the shower one day about 10 years ago.
That's my space too.
That's so amazing.
So funny. Yep.
I got these little, and I would recommend them, I got these little waterproof notepads that you can just stick on your shower wall 12 years ago or something. And I started thinking about writing a book because a lot of my articles were appearing in other people's books in the footnotes. And most of them were written by men who had joined the cybersecurity beat long after I had. And I thought, why should I let these men tell these stories I know better than anyone? And so I decided to write a book, and I started in the shower with the title. You know, the title came to me in the shower. And then I started thinking of my chapter headings and putting those on these little waterproof notepads in the shower. And that really became my book proposal. And the reason I chose This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends is because when I first joined the New York Times to cover cybersecurity, like I said, I'd gone out of my way to know as little about cybersecurity as possible. And everyone I interviewed, particularly in government and the security industry, would tell me that we were in for a, quote, cyber Pearl Harbor, some kind of cyber-induced calamitous attack that would take down the grid or cause a Fukushima-like incident at a nuclear plant, or, you know, contaminate the drinking water supply. And I would always ask them, okay, well, how long until we have that kind of attack? And almost comically, they all had the same answer. It was always 18 to 24 months. We will see this in 18 to 24 months. And it was just close enough to add urgency to their prediction and just far enough away that if it didn't happen, I might not hold them to it. And so that's sort of how the title came to be. But I also liked the idea of calling it, "This is how they tell me the world ends," because it gave me a little bit of similar plausible deniability. But also just because by the end of the book, I say, listen, you know, we haven't had the big mushroom cloud yet. We've come very close. We've seen Russia target our nuclear plants. They got into a Wolf Creek nuclear plant in Kansas. We've seen them hack into our power grid. We saw a screenshot a few years ago that the Department of Homeland Security released that came out actually on my drive to Aspen from Boulder. That showed Russian hackers with their fingers on the controls at a U.S. power plant. We have seen them turn off the lights in Ukraine only for a few hours, but they did it twice and it was enough to send a message. But I don't actually think any country wants to shut the power off anywhere else beyond sending a short political message, because especially if they did so here, we could just turn around and do the same to them. And so although it's sort of spooky and scary movie Hollywood to focus on the big cyber Pearl Harbor, I actually come away from the book and from my own journey saying that in some ways it's just a distraction from where we already are, which is that everything worth intercepting in the United States has already been intercepted. Our personal data, our bank accounts, our hospitals have been held hostage with ransomware. Chinese hackers have stolen our intellectual property from some of the most vibrant companies in the United States. We have seen Russians get into the power grid and into our nuclear plants. And now we're unwinding this Russian attack on our federal IT networks that could take years to really unwind. So forget about the mushroom cloud and the power grid outages for a moment. And let's just wake up and see what's happening right now, which is sometimes really hard to see because it plays out in sort of this invisible domain in a language that few among us can actually understand, but it's hitting us in more visceral ways. And so that's sort of the journey of the book title. The TV show is really exciting. I don't actually know how this happened. And I really need to sit down with Tommy Shalami, who is the director who optioned the book, who most people will know from West Wing, although he's directed more recent shows like The Plot Against America, and he's directed some House of Cards episodes and episodes of The Americans, and is a really well-respected director, and he's actually president of the Directors Guild. And so in some ways, he's in charge of dictating how Hollywood starts filming again in COVID. But someone got him the script. It might have been Creative Artist Agency who represents me. It might have been a hacker. I have no idea. And somehow it made its way into Tommy's hands, and he asked to do a phone call, and he loved the title. That I think is what initially drew him to the project. And he also loved the approach, which was that this was a story about people. It wasn't a story about computers or people just sitting at their computers. I really tried to tell the story of these humans and how we're all connected digitally these days, in some of the same ways we're now learning about in the pandemic that we can't ignore. And so he loved that. And he had a deal with FX, which I think mandated that he give them right of first refusal to any project. And so he brought this to FX, and they read it in a week and they signed on to it. And they brought on these two writers who had done a spectacular show for BBC before called The Informant. And I had watched the show and I knew that they had taken a really nuanced approach to a story about I forget what his background was, but a Middle Easterner in London who was recruited as an informant to sort of infiltrate Al-Qaeda in this terror cell. But it wasn't done in a really Hollywood way. It was done in this really nuanced, almost humorous way. And so I knew that they weren't going to bastardize this book. And so they all signed on, and it's been in development, and I think they're through outlining or even done with the screenplay maybe for season one. And I don't think I'm in it. They're really playing around.
I was wondering.
I think they're playing around with time in really interesting ways. Like the show will start with some kind of cyber-induced calamitous attack, like the one I was just describing, that looks something like 9/11 with people racing down buildings. And one woman is racing up and gets to the rooftop and looks around, and there's helicopters and ambulances and people are running and there's smoke. And she just does this dance that is sort of like her resignation dance to the world ending. And she's wearing this orange sari. This is all I've collected from this right now. She has this beautiful dance that shows that she's sort of, this is the dance she's been preparing to do at the moment of the world's end. And then it pauses there and said, this is how they tell me the world ends. And then it backtracks into her story. Every show will feature some element of that cyber-induced attack. But it's, again, about the humans who are somehow involved in the lead up to it. And so that's the general idea behind the show. It's very loosely based on my book, and probably for the better. But I'm really excited about it, and they seem really excited about it. And FX seems very committed to it, and they're being very picky with their projects these days. So when they do sign on, they don't just sign on to take it away from other studios. And so that's sort of where things are.
So exciting. And I feel so fortunate to speak to you within like a 24-hour period of your announcement of the next chapter and focus of your life. And I love how you are looking for that balance, and you are an incredible storyteller. And that's how I have responded to your writing. And yeah, grateful for our conversation today.
Me too. And I also feel like that panel we did was a shifting moment. And I'm so happy that we got to speak today. And I would like you to email me that that step that you read at the beginning of the conversation, because that couldn't have come at a more perfect time. And it's just lovely to hear your own story and your own search for balance and freedom. And it's just really cool that this has all come full circle. So
I think so too.
Let's keep in touch.
Yeah, it's a complicated life, and we, you know, have our roles and responsibilities to play, which include giving voice to people we admire and respect. So glad to be able to talk with you today.
Me too. And as soon as this is over, I will come down to Orange County and come check out the museum, and maybe we can get Rena involved and go to Jelena or something for lunch.
That is a date.
Okay.
That is a date for sure. Okay. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay. You too. So great talking to you, Heidi. Thank you so much.
You too. Okay.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Conversations About Art is part of HiZ.art. This episode was produced by Simon Illa. Our theme music was composed by Eric McDougall. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and review us on whichever platform you listened, as it helps us further our goal of connecting all to art. We will be back again every other Tuesday with new episodes. Thanks so much for listening.